always a great pleasure to have our next guest in the studio because it means that he has released another very cool book, and he writes these right in our backyard, and they're wonderful books that receive great accolades, great awards, and we're just thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to him. He's a 3-time National Book Award finalist. He is going to be having a release party for his new book, Born to Fly, the first women's air race across America. Steve Scheinkin will be at the Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs on Tuesday at 6 p.m. Born to Fly is the story of the fearless women pilots who aimed for the skies and beyond just 9 years after American women finally got the right to vote. A group of trailblazers soared to new heights in the 1929 Air Derby, the first women's air race across the United States. It is a great pleasure to welcome Steve Scheinkin back to the Roundtable. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Again, the name of the new book is Born to Fly, the first women's air race across America. The book officially comes out Tuesday.
Yeah, it's been, as always, a long time in the making, so it's exciting. This kind of, it's the only time goes slowly, I find, is that the month before a book comes out and you just want to start talking about it.
So you have written about Jim Thorpe. Your past books have included, well, you wrote about Benedict Arnold.
Of course. Yes.
Bomb, Port Chicago 50. So the obvious question then is, how did you come to this race and to this amazing group of women?
It is an amazing story. I'm sort of a collector, or have become, of these obscure but exciting American history stories. And I find that the only way to find them is just to kind of keep your ears and eyes open. And sometimes, and I don't believe in supernatural things in any aspect of life other than this, they just find you. So for instance, for this story, someone mentioned a pilot, one of the pilots in this race who I'd never heard of, and I just kind of filed that away. But I'm sure you've had this experience where we hear something once, and then the next day you hear about it again, and then again. And so I walked into a hotel room, and a documentary about this race was on the TV, which if someone hadn't mentioned the name of the pilot the day before, I would have just turned to CNN or something. And it just found me. And then I become obsessed, because then I said, an air race across America with Amelia Earhart and 20 of the greatest pilots all at once. And it was a Super Bowl of its time, and yet it's a really little-known story today.
Given that you write primarily for a young adult audience, do you look at your stories as, okay, this would be good for that purpose versus this would be good for doing a full-fledged major adult history?
I don't think about the audience too much, other than to think about what I would have liked, both as a middle schooler and what I like today, because I'm the one who has to spend 2 years with this story. And so I have to be very excited about it, or it just doesn't work. And that comes through, or doesn't, in the writing anyway, if you have that excitement for it. So I try not to think about who may or may not be interested beyond what excites me.
But these stories that you have chosen have an excitement built into them. They have an excitement. There's an arc. There's a beginning, middle, and an end.
And they're
exciting just in what they are.
I hope so. I mean, I had two, in addition to dozens of other jobs, two mini careers before this. One was trying to make movies, which failed, but I learned a lot about storytelling and how to work in visuals and keep things moving in a plot based way. And then the other was textbook writing. I wrote history textbooks for years, which I'm very sorry that I did that. Now I have my daughter's in eighth grade, and she brings home one of these big, heavy textbooks, which her teacher thankfully doesn't use. But I still am reminded, okay, I don't want to write that. So I've drawn, how do you tell a story, like you say, with a beginning, middle, and end, which movies do, and how do you convey the importance and excitement of history and how we need to know these things, but never to be boring, never to turn it into a list of names and dates and facts.
Before we talk about the story itself, that your work in screenwriting, though, certainly I've noticed this in your work, and of course many have pointed it out, that you have a cinematic style. There is a distillation of the information in a very lovely way, and with great excitement and a cinematic scope.
I hope so. Thank you. That's really nice to hear. If the term visual learner had existed when I was a child, I would have been that, as yeah. opposed to just like an average. I wonder why he's not doing better on his ELA English tests, you know, which was where I was at. I need to make things visual. And so one of the great things you learn when you're writing or taking a class about writing screenplays is to literally make them visual and tactile, even to put all your ideas for scenes on cards and move them around like a puzzle and take out anything that slows down the action. And I still rely on those kinds of techniques when I organize.
Well, you talk about those techniques, but I mean, one of the techniques is that it because you have these bits and bursts of information, it comes off as the word went completely out of my head, Steve. It's a page turner. You know, you get that yarn where you're just like, oh, good. I have to five more pages. I got to find out what mm-hmm. happens, and and 10 more. I got to find what happens.
That's really good to hear. That's exactly what, and again, I'm going back to what I want to read, whether right. I'm thinking of the middle school me or the current me.
So let us talk about the first women's air race across America. This took place in 1929 Air Derby. And as you mentioned, you know, I'd never heard about this prior to this book. I mean, maybe I had, but I don't know. It didn't make much of a, I knew about Amelia Earhart.
Right.
And then other than that, I did not
She's
much.
The one. She's the one people know about. But these races, I wasn't joking, they were the Super Bowl before the Super Bowl existed. This was a huge sport in the 1920s. And they would have these week-long air derbies across the country. So thousands of miles and several stages throughout a week. And hundreds of thousands of people would show up at the airfields. There would always be crashes, almost always fatalities in these races. And women were totally excluded from it. And it was just considered inappropriate for women to be doing this sort of dangerous sport. And Amelia and her community of young pilots, and they were all in their 20s, basically had to insist, no, we're ready. We're good enough. We're ready. We've been pushing the limits in our planes, and we're ready to have our own race. And this race in 1929 was really the first and the only of its kind because of the Depression falling right after it. It just featured everyone, all the top racers. They were all friends, but they were also rivals, and they all wanted to win. And they all got fast planes for this one and only race across America.
And then you, I'm kind of putting the cart before the horse here, but in the end, you talk about then where they go after that, which is really interesting because, as you say, that it was kind of the one and only. And then after that, they all go their way, but they have interesting contributions to make following that.
Absolutely. Many of them, and people who are into aviation history know names like Louise Staden and Marvel Crossan and Pancho Barnes, and they did make great contributions. The Depression really played a factor in the 20s, in the late 20s, when these women were getting really good at flying. They could get sponsorships, you know, by oil companies or plane companies, and they could work in aviation, and some were able to in the 30s, but it was just much tougher, which is what also makes this race such a one of a kind.
You forget the timing of this, but so you have a photo in here of Pancho Barnes surrounded by fellow pilots, including Chuck Yeager.
Right. Yes.
That's such a cool photo.
She had a great second career beyond this. She set all kinds of aviation records, but she also had a club in the desert that became known as the Happy Bottom Riding Club. That was near Edwards Air Force Base. So a lot of those, you know, right stuff kind of pilots came and blew off steam in her bar, which is exactly the kind of atmosphere that she wanted.
What are the challenges in writing these histories?
Part of it is finding the story, because, again, I want that page-turning story, and I'm not allowed to make anything up. You know, I love writing nonfiction, but, of course, you need to do the research and find the story. So that's half, and then the other half is getting in the information, because you do need to, especially if you're writing for a younger audience. And I am aware that I can't just jump into a story without providing any context or background information. And so how do you keep the scenes moving quickly while providing just enough of that background information and context so that it all makes sense and that you come away with a full, you know, a complete story where you both were entertained and actually learned something?
Who is the mind behind the air derby, the women's air derby?
This really came from the women themselves. I mean, they proposed it. Amelia Earhart was already famous. She had flown the Atlantic, but kind of not really, because she was just a passenger. So she was very well aware that her fame, well, she probably would have said was undeserved at that time. She really wanted to prove herself. And she would go on to do that, of course. But these top pilots insisted on having their own race. They were setting records. They were celebrities in their own right, setting aviation records such as altitude. This was a very hardcore thing to go up in an open plane with, maybe if you're lucky, you can borrow some oxygen equipment from a fire department, because you're going to pass out when you get above 20,000 feet. And so they were famous, and they had a little bit of pull at that time, and people did want to see them race.
What was it? I mean, how do you even get a plane? I mean, you know, of I assume it was as expensive then comparatively as it is now.
It was. And some, like Pancho, had some money. She was born with some money and was able to buy planes. Most of them needed to get sponsors.
Yeah.
So they proved themselves. Marvel Crossan, who's one of the great pilots in this story, she and her brother fell so in love with aviation in the 20s, they built their own plane. They kind of bought pieces from people who were getting rid of planes from World War I and put it together in their backyard, which you could say is not great parenting. But their parents actually saw them doing it and said, look, this is their life. We can't stop them. And they both became famous aviators. So this was their destiny. And so they learned to fly on planes like that. And then when they got good enough, were able to get sponsorships, usually from aviation or oil companies, who said, oh, yeah, we want Marvel in this race flying a travel airplane or whatever brand, so that she's going to win. And just like Nike or Adidas today, they would sponsor the racers.
How would a race work? I mean, so you all take off at the same, how's that work?
Yeah, they take off, it has to be staggered, obviously, right? A minute or 2 minutes between takeoff. But every pilot is just timed. You know, there are timers and judges, both when you're taking off, so everyone is individually timed. And when you cross the line, there's a line on a field at the finish line for each leg of the race, which is 100, 200 miles per leg.
And it goes days.
This lasted 9 days.
Yeah,
I think 20 stages over 9 days. So weather is obviously a factor, and there was at least one delay for weather. But yeah, you're going all out. And these planes are obviously a lot slower than today's planes. They could do 150 miles an hour, usually on a good day. So you would be flying all day. And it was physically exhausting. It was very hot, but also just physically exhausting to muscle these planes around in the sky.
The book is just fascinating and so much fun. It is Born to Fly, The First Women's Air Race Across America by Steve Scheinken. Steve is going to be having a release party for his new book at the North Shire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York. On Tuesday, the 24th of September, takes place at 6 p.m., and you'll be reading and signing and doing all that
stuff. Absolutely, all that stuff. Please come see me there.
Excellent. Again, it is Steve Scheinken and the new book, Born to Fly. Steve, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. I love coming down here.
Thank you so much. We look forward to your next adventure. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.